Welcome to the Against the Stream Nashville podcast. In keeping with the Buddha's encouragement to ensure that these teachings are freely offered to all, we do not have any set dues or fees associated with any of our classes or media. In an effort to sustain our ability to do so, we ask that you contribute via our website at againstthestreamnashville.com by clicking the Donate tab, or via the mobile app Venmo by sending a donation to the username at ATS Nashville. Enjoy.
I'm very happy to have Scott here. We've been hanging out quite a bit and talking Dharma. Scott has been a Tibetan monk for 9 years, and so he's relocated to Brooklyn and teaches up there, and he's been teaching this weekend at Against the Stream. So I talked him into doing another class today. He's been teaching a lot. And we wanted to talk a little bit about these first two path factors in kind of the early Buddhist map of the Eightfold Path, which is view and intention. The past few weeks, I've been talking about the four foundations of mindfulness. And I've been talking about these three qualities of presence and awareness and this weird word, equanimity. Presence is this quality of having more availability and access to a wider range of our experience. So having this kind of commitment, like we did at the beginning of the meditation practice, this commitment to show up more for more. And I think that's a simple quality that, you know, the Buddha's Dharma, or really the Buddha's teachings on mindfulness, is asking us to consider. He says that when we start to meditate, we should set this intention to put aside our desire and discontent for the world, right? All of the shit that we're tripping about the future, or the stuff that we're consumed by in the past. And just like making that commitment, I already experienced some relief in just saying, okay, I'm going to, like, for these next 20, 30 minutes, not just sit here and go up in worry mode. I think some Harvard psychology study I've heard before said that 43% of our day we're thinking about something that's not happening right now. Right? That's a...
Seems like a low number.
Yeah, it seems like a low number, right? But then I think they said it's about 50,000 thoughts. Right, and so this is just thinking about things that aren't happening right now. There are more thoughts about what I'm doing right now, but this is just like future and past scenarios. And so this commitment to presence is important. I think it's one of the things that we're really developing through this practice. Another is the commitment to awareness. Awareness is living with more clarity of how we're impacted or affected by the wide range of these experiences, right? So, you know, it's an ability to be here, but also to be curious while we're here. Right? Like I gave the example of, like, a dog is very present, but maybe not so aware. So, like, having this inquiry, which we're going to talk about tonight, this inquiry of what is this experience, how is it, and what does it need? What's the skillful way to meet this experience? You know, having this familiarity with what we're experiencing, through mindfulness, we can develop this almost inner map, or this sense of, oh, I know this. I've sat with this mind state of doubt. Or I've sat with this worry. I've sat with this restlessness. So to know that experience, and then to know how to be with it, to allow that experience, or to have some access to it, and to know how to work with it, right? And awareness helps us to do this, to have this clarity into how we're impacted and affected by our experiences. And the third thing that I think is a really important aspect of mindfulness is developing equanimity, which is an ability to be with the experience without pushing or pulling on it. Easier said than done. That's always my consensus on that. But that's part of what we're developing in practice. And so The Buddha, of course, he encouraged the development of mindfulness. In ancient, early Buddhist texts, they didn't call mindfulness a meditation practice. They called it bhavana, which is cultivation. So we're developing, we're cultivating this awareness, this presence, this equanimity. And I think there are two ways to look at why or what we're developing through mindfulness. It's like kind of two paths. There are probably multiple, but in my mind, there are two ways of kind of approaching mindfulness. One is from this interest in using mindfulness to help create spaciousness. So to not be as reactive, to be open, to be able to be with our experience, to non-reactively observe thoughts, emotions, and sensations in the present. And the other way of orienting to practice is looking at it as for the purpose of developing liberating insight, allowing us to look directly into the nature of suffering in the mind and how to uproot it. And the Buddha called mindfulness the direct path to liberation. And so I think it was really clear what he was interested in using mindfulness for. You know, it's this direct path to liberation. He was teaching a way to skillfully engage with our lives and to develop spaciousness and non-reactivity, but for a purpose of liberation. And for the development of insight. Insight, I like the definition, is the capacity to gain an accurate and deep intuitive understanding of a person, place, thing, or idea. Right? I've been sharing this every week as I've been talking about mindfulness. And a capacity to gain an accurate and deep intuitive understanding. And we're looking into our experience with awareness to try to know what it's like, how it's impacting us, and how, what a skillful response to it would be. In the Western world, we like to know about things. So it's like this kind of insight is more about like what I know. I know about mental health, psychology, I know about theories, I know about a lot of concepts and ideas. And in the Buddha's teaching, he was inviting us to look into our experience immediately and directly, to know experience as it is. This word in Pali Sanskrit is opanayako, which means to be brought inwardly, to look at something inwardly. And I hope this is intuitive for a lot of us. Like, we all have insight. I think if you're alive and you have the ability to, like, learn and remember and all these things, you have insight. We've all had moments of awakening, many of them, where it's like, oh, shit, I'm doing this again. I notice I'm doing this again. I know that it's causing suffering, and I don't want to do it anymore, so I'm going to do something else. And we've all had those moments. With mindfulness, we have more intention around cultivating and developing this knowing of experience, this insight. And so, talking about view, our view, I think it's important to kind of look at what the Buddha maybe intended around teaching wise view. Like, what's the importance of our view, how we see things? And I think the first place to start is, I think what the Buddha was saying, or what I know about my view, is that it's inaccurate a lot of the time. So I think one of the first things, or one of the first steps maybe in approaching my mind, is that my mind does not see things accurately a lot of the time. And why we don't see clearly, or why I don't see accurately all the time, is one, that I have a limited experience. I have a limited view. I'm only me. I've only experienced what I've experienced. And we even know in neuroscience, there's a guy named Dr. Joseph Dispenza, and he said that the brain processes 40 billion bits of information a second. 40 billion. But we're only aware of 2,000 of those bits in a second. So the brain processes, but we're only in our awareness is only 2,000, right? And so there's that kind of like very logical or very scientific kind of aspect. But for me, it's just like I've only experienced what I've experienced, so I have a limited view. And then we don't always have the correct information, right? That's another part, is that we often react to our interpretations of experience rather than the experience itself. So I see things based upon how I've seen them before, right? Or I see things based upon how they feel, and I don't even maybe am aware of how I feel, and so I just react or act. And so we misperceive a lot of times, or we perceive based upon old information. Joseph Goldstein says something like, the story of your mom is not your mom. Mm-hmm. I like, you know, and we know this even with like trauma, with people that experience distress, things that happen to us that we can't control, like traumas. Our bodies, unknown to us, store emotional reactions to these events. They call it implicit memory. Then when we encounter similar events in our current life or triggers, our implicit memories activate. So you may get really activated, something in the present that isn't even present. It's old. And so the need for like looking at how we're looking is kind of what one way to think about wise views. Like, how do I see this experience? How do I, what's the lens I'm wearing? It's almost like the glasses I'm wearing. Why do we need to see clearly? Bhikkhu Bodhi says the importance of right view can be gauged from the fact that our perspectives on the crucial issues of reality and value have a bearing that goes beyond mere theoretical convictions. Our views govern our attitudes, our actions, our whole orientation to existence. Our views might not be clearly formulated in our mind. We might only have a hazy conceptual grasp of our beliefs, but whether formulated or not, expressed or maintained in silence, these views have a far-reaching influence. They structure our perceptions, order our values, crystallize into the ideational framework through which we interpret to ourselves the meaning of our being in the world. And what I like about this is he says that even if our views aren't really fully formulated, we still react from them. And so why we need to look at them is because that's what's the basis of how we relate to our world. And one of a really simple way of looking at this is like, look at all the views that we throw around every day. Like getting on social media for 5 seconds, the amount of views that are just spilling out. And if we hold to a view, the Buddha said the most dangerous thing about views is when we fix to them. So it's not the view in and of itself that's bad or wrong necessarily. It's about holding to fixed views. And I just think about how much of my suffering comes from holding to fixed views. And being in a world that changes, being in a body that changes, an experience that I grow through, and having to constantly reevaluate how I view myself in the world. And so, the way I like to look at this too is that the Buddha talked about karma, this idea of action. And action starts really with our thoughts. It's in our speech, in our behaviors. He said that beings are the owners of their actions, the heirs of their actions. They spring from their actions, are bound to their actions, and are supported by their actions. Whatever deeds they do, that they shall fall heir to. And so in every moment of experience, like how I'm viewing the world is kind of conditioning itself. It's like our views are reinforced by thinking about them. He said that whatever one thinks and ponders upon becomes the inclination of the mind. Whatever we think about, you know, the mind takes that view again and takes that view again and takes that view again. And so a big part of what we're doing is being really careful about how we think about things and what we do up here. Thinking is a behavior. Just like when I exercise a muscle, I get stronger at it. When I exercise an obsession or a worry or a judgment or a cynical, critical belief about something, I get strong at that. And so we really want to look at, you know, this part of our mind and our conditioning, how we condition. Those are some of my thoughts for now.
So we were talking earlier, and what Andrew's pointing out, this idea that in reality that view matters, and that in a sense we're kind of stuck with a view for now, right? I mean, most of us are stuck with our concepts whether we like it or not for the moment. And so the first part of the path is just understanding, like Andrew said, that we have a view. A lot of us like to just say, well, I just feel this, right? In my gut, right? I just feel it happening. And, you know, when that's left unquestioned, it's usually, you know, maybe sometimes innocent, mostly unhelpful, and sometimes actually dangerous, right? Because we know there's a lot of bad ideas out there in the world that do harm. Right, we can see this sometimes in religion. We can see this sometimes in political ideologies and views. Wars happen based off of bad ideas, right, and disagreements, and they happen based off of a view. So I think this is actually a huge step when we're able to just use mindfulness as a tool to come inwards and to recognize, oh, okay, I have a view for now. And that, and it's not a view. There's many views, right? There's many different perceptions happening, many different ideas that we have. And so as we start to look, as we start to look towards, we may recognize with more objectivity, hopefully over time through meditation, that those views are not fixed, that they are a lens that we see through. And this is I don't know, it depends on the person. I don't know if it's necessarily like an easy thing. It took me a lot of practice to come to that as an experience. As a logical idea, I think it's pretty easy to understand. But what is that like in our experience? Coming into a sense of and directly seeing our lens, right? So this is the power of meditation. As we put in our time on the cushion and our time throughout the day with awareness, the point is not to deceive ourselves anymore, you see? And the point is also to recognize when we are deceiving ourselves, we're the ones who lose. It's not someone else who loses. I mean, of course, we can do a tremendous harm through deceiving ourselves. We can also deceive others. But at the end of the day, it's us who remains in our illusion, right? And so this first step is not by any means simple or beginner, you know? It's quite profound because sort of half the battle takes place when we're able to recognize that we have a lens or many lenses that we see through. And then, of course, we miss most of those. We might catch one or two, like if we have some close friends or a partner where we're able to communicate skillfully. It's a chance for us to unpack our lenses in order to have healthy relationship. This is a good, I think, a positive thing about relationships is it often forces us to look at our views. It forces us to look at our lenses because our lens is a lens. It's not the lens, right? So you see right there, you know, when my girlfriend doesn't like my lens, you know, it's sort of like, well, I got a choice here. I can either remain stubborn that my lens is the right way or my view is the right way here, or that there's another possibility. And not that her possibility is better necessarily. It's just that there is another one. So there's also compassion embodied in there. So within insight practice, compassion is kind of inherent within it. after we, as we develop it and as that grows. Because compassion is a willingness to come into a sense of a wish to see and connect with suffering as it is, to connect with suffering and dissatisfaction it is as it is, and a wish for it to change, that ourselves or another can be free from that. And so when we come into contact with our lens, someone else points it out, or there's an opportunity to open and develop and to change our view or change our opinion, there's also an opportunity to open our heart towards another, right? Which is a huge thing. It's not something I think, I don't take that lightly. And so when we're consistently doing this, and when our mindful awareness is consistently pointing us back to this, Buddhahood is not that far, actually. Enlightenment's not that far. I mean, you know, we got a few more lifetimes. But it's really not that far if we're aiming that view then towards awakening. So one thing we were talking about too was, after this first step, we're still stuck with our concepts. It's not like we've blown apart all concepts. And of course, we can get into a whole discussion of what is there if there's no concept. That's a really interesting thing to talk about, but I'm probably not going to go there tonight. But there's still this idea that we are kind of upgrading our view within the Buddhist tradition. So as long as we're stuck with a view, we might as well have one that's useful, beneficial, wholesome, and compassionate, right? And then, of course, we have lots of arguments of what that is, right? Every religion is saying, you know, or every, not just religion, secularism, atheism, they're all saying we have the right idea of what the best view is, right? Now, this is where I think it gets really interesting in Buddhism, because the Buddha is just simply offering his insight. Okay, this is a view that is beneficial for the moment, and then these views progress as we move through the Buddhist path, and then eventually the idea is to present a view that takes you beyond view. So this is the real power of Buddhism, and it's actually, for me, it's what continually brings me back to engaging with it as a non-dogmatic spiritual path, as an approach to introspection and relying on a temporary view that can upgrade over time, but eventually that view is aimed at going beyond all views. We have a praise of the Buddha, which I repeated this weekend when I taught, where we praise the Buddha as someone who has gone beyond view, right? And again, this is alluding to ultimate truth in Buddhism. But essentially we can see, even when we have a really nice view, like a really acceptable, wholesome, kind, you know, likable view, it's still a view, and therefore it's binding. But in the meantime, we have no choice. So this is where Buddhist ethics come in, where we're adopting a view that's in line with nonviolent behavior, with a policy of do no harm, and then if we can go beyond that, help, right? So Buddhist ethics are framed out in this. And so what's so inspiring, I think, is this is the Buddha offering, like I said, his, you know, insight into, okay, here's some temporary views to move you along, and then here's the ultimate going beyond view. And then we have a choice of how to check that. You know, we have our job of investigating, okay, let's check this out for myself, right? The Buddha famously said, don't just take my teaching on faith. Really rub it like you would check for real gold. Check it, burn it, you know, investigate it, right? So we're allowed to come with our skepticism. But of course, as we're checking it, we're working with our lenses at the same time. So it's very skillful. It's very profound, I think. So then what do? So we have this idea first, you know, that we're looking, that, you know, just a recognition that we have lenses that may not be universal, right? Just a recognition of that. And then coming, and then using the Buddhist path to see which ones are wholesome and which ones are not, and trying to grow more wholesome attitudes, right? So one way, a Tibetan Buddhist teacher I study with, I like the way he frames this out. So one way to explain view in Buddhism, and what I do want to say is, this doesn't mean that there's just, what's the word? Like we can just make up our own view here. No, the Buddhist path has a view, right? It has which I'm going to talk about in a second, which is what we're investigating here through our study and practice. But he kind of described view itself as an idea, then you have the, sorry, I messed up. You have view, and then you have meditation, and you have conduct. So this is one way we kind of frame out the Buddhist path. So view here is like an idea. Then when we sit down to meditate, we're not just working with some random thing or just spacing out. We meditate on that view to get used to that view, to bring it about, to sort of upgrade our sort of funky lens into a more wholesome lens. And then from there, another wholesome lens until we're completely out of lenses. So we have the view, what we're an idea, we're meditating to get used to it, and then the conduct and the fruition is sort of like obtaining that view, where it's not just, like Andrew said, it's not just a cognitive experience of I know. It's a deeply felt experience that not only we have, but transformed our life, right? And we became we took on a different quality. We became a different person through that, right? And so in general, the view we're trying to get used to within the Buddhist path is what we call the three marks or the three characteristics of impermanence, the nature of suffering or dissatisfaction, and anatta, or this idea that what we experience, emotional perception, thoughts, are not personal, right? They're not personal, universally personal, right? And so, especially the third one, it takes a lot of investigation, it takes a lot of meditation to unwrap that, right? But even through some simple practices like the one we did yesterday, for those of you who were here, just observing, watching, we start to notice we are not our emotions, we are not our thoughts, right? And so we start to gain a little bit of spaciousness, a little bit of freedom. And we would say eventually if we continue with this process, it leads to a sense that these are not universally, or I should say these are not fundamentally who we are, right? But we start with impermanence. We start with just a recognition that the identity we perceive, the emotion that's moving through, the thought process that's happening, the argument we're having with someone, is not a permanent phenomenon. It's changeable. It moves, right? And we challenge the view, we challenge the lens that it's permanent. Now, permanent in this sense, it's not asking you to, first, of course, it's investigating with a conceptual idea, but that's easy. We all know things are impermanent. You know, it's not that hard to get that kind of conviction. If you just look at, you know, a flower long enough, you know, you see that things are impermanent. We see humans, you know, go from being a baby to aging to dying. So we all see that things are changing all the time. They're in movement. They're in process. But do we fully feel that in our bones, right? And so the first view we're getting used to and what we're training in through meditation is just recognizing experientially the impermanent nature of phenomena. And this is incredibly liberating as it develops as an experience. As a cognitive conceptual idea, it's helpful, but it's not that liberating at the beginning because it's just an idea, it's just a concept. But as our familiarity with impermanence develops and changes, we start to see that phenomena and the nature of our experience is much more fluid. We have a metaphor for this in Mahayana Buddhism where we say, you know, we mostly perceive our experience as ice, but the nature of ice is water. It's not ice, right? And so we can see that it's possible to recognize that ice is actually water. And it's possible to actually melt that ice through the warmth of meditation, through this warmth of awareness. And so our challenge, I think, socially and culturally, at least for me it's been a challenge, is getting out of our heads with this, right? And getting to the cushion. Because if we don't get to the cushion, I mean that metaphorically also, meaning turning towards throughout the day with awareness towards our experience, as well as informal meditation. If we don't do that, it just remains as an idea, just remains as another nice concept we heard at a Dharma talk. And, you know, it's cool and it's maybe inspiring, but unless we put in the work to recognize that directly, it won't fundamentally affect the lenses that much. Okay? So this view is something we're getting used to. And it's also a view that challenges the very fundamentals of what binds us to suffering. Right? So the reason these three marks are there, they're not just religious principles. They're actually principles the Buddha found that are the nature of reality, the nature of how the world, the universe, our minds, our bodies function in reality. Similarly with the second of the marks, you know, when we ignore suffering, we're ignoring reality, right? I mean, we have so many tools for ignoring reality right now, and it's getting worse and worse, right? And as you see in society, the more we ignore reality, the more we suffer. The more we ignore suffering, the more we suffer, strangely enough, right? So our job is to turn towards, right? To turn towards to see clearly, or to have these small and larger insights, which eventually lead to this third mark, that phenomena, self, the nature of thoughts, emotions, are not personal, though we take them personal. You know, if I tell you to point and say, where, when you say I, where is that I? You know, point and say me. What are you going to point at, right? You're going to point maybe here somewhere, maybe your brain, maybe your heart, maybe your foot, I don't know. You'll point somewhere and say I. But when we really check, where can we find that? Is it in your heart? Is it in your brain somewhere? If we take apart the pieces of the brain, if we take apart your ears and beards and noses, right? Where is that? So we have to really do our due diligence here to see things are not nothing, but also what we've constructed is very dreamlike. It's like an illusion that we believe our own illusion all the time, every day. So awareness is eventually seen clearly into that illusory nature. But we can learn to dance with that illusion. So one of my teachers, he says, we call this relative and ultimate truth, where relative truth, in a, if I put it in a simple way, it's like the experience, the perception we have now. But ultimately we can see, it's not like that. It's actually like water instead of ice. But we can also have a dance between those, right? On the one side, we're not denying that there's something happening. So we talked about this other phrase my teacher really likes to speak on, where he says, whatever we're experiencing, whatever phenomena, sight, sound, it's real, it's happening, but it's not true. Because when we investigate for truth, we can't find it. Like I would ask you, you know, investigate for some true self that doesn't change, that's independent from anything else, that's singular and autonomous. We can't find that, right? But there's something there. There is a reality happening. There is a sort of a magical movie being played. Or we used to have this, they have this traditional example in Buddhism of, I guess there was magicians in India who could conjure like a whole dancing troupe, you know? And people who walked by really thought there was dancers there, you know? But there wasn't. It was just an illusion the magician conjured. But the magician knew, right? He knew that it was an illusion. So essentially, through awareness, we're trying to become like that magician. Where there's an illusion happening, but we can recognize it. And this doesn't mean that things don't matter. It actually means that things matter more, right? So here's where our actions matter. Our karma matters. How we show up in the world really matters, right? But at the same time, we can't find a universality to it. What we can find at the end of the day is awareness and its expression, which is compassion, right? And so compassion is a very interesting thing from a Buddhist perspective, just to tie it in here, because I think compassion really is a reflection of Buddhist ethics. Because when we look at every ethic from a Buddhist perspective, they're aimed at compassion, and not just relative compassion, but an ultimate compassion, right? Coming out of what is going to unbind ourselves and others from dukkha, or this nature of dissatisfaction, or this nature of suffering. And for me, this is what really makes up the Buddhist path and what makes it quite distinct from just religious dogma, right? Because the aim is to bring about the view of impermanence, nature of suffering, and the nature of self, right? Of that being much more open-dimensional than we experience it. The aim is that. So the aim for awareness is that. But those three in themselves are also a process of not just blind belief, but investigation and seeing. Oh, is that how things actually are, right? So to me, this is what I find incredibly inspiring within the path and within this practice of awareness. Because Buddhism in some ways, you know, I've been studying it for a long time. And in Tibetan Buddhism, we have a lot of like pretty heavy philosophical tradition. They do in Theravada tradition as well. A lot of philosophy, a lot of sutras to study and kind of analyze and read commentaries on. And it gets very subtle. But at the end of the day, unless we've connected with our awareness, and we've developed that towards openness, towards freedom, towards aiming at getting unbound from what binds us, and it's just words. Yeah. So it's important to know, but as one of my teachers told me when I kind of complained to him one time, he said, practice what you know, right? And then, of course, your knowledge will continue, your practice will develop, and then we have insights, and those small insights lead to medium insights, and those medium insights lead to larger and bigger insights. And then eventually, we start to feel content, and we have a completely different way to relate to our experience, and the compassionate heart can evolve naturally from there, not from a pity mentality for someone else, a self-righteousness, or a religious dogma, or sort of what's often so prevalent today in sort of progressive liberalism of like a do-gooder mentality. So we have such a need to be useful, but a lot of times our usefulness just fucks things up more, right? I mean, think about it. So we have to be very careful, because here on the Buddhist path, wisdom and compassion are a unity, and they go together. So whenever there's an act of compassion, if it's devoid of wisdom, be careful. You never know where that's going to go. And if there's a mind of wisdom without compassion, it's so dry, has no efficacy, right? So I don't know what I want to end on, but that's I'll end it there at least for now.
And I'll say, you know, the wisdom and compassion as unity is kind of this active potential to see clearly and to respond wisely. And that I like what you were sharing, Scott, about we do have views, you know. It's just about recognizing, for me, it's about recognizing that I'm not always seeing clearly, that I am very limited. You know, and we were talking earlier, like this is Zen Buddhist concept of beginner's mind, of approaching experiences brand new. You know, thinking I know what the experience is, or thinking I have that like intuitive feeling about it, but really taking that extra moment to just see, to like, to bring awareness to it, you know, and so where we start a lot of the times in Buddhist practice is we start with, in the Theravadan tradition, is we start with the Buddha encouraged practicing service and practicing wise association. It's like practicing helping us get active and connecting with other people and serving other people. Because there's something about this unity of wisdom and compassion, of seeing that we're all stuck in a horrible mess of views. You know, and like I like to look at our political divisiveness as that. It's like, and not to be dismissive of it, like we have to find views to work with this mess that we're in. But it's a mess, you know, and we're stuck in a mess of views, and just that everyone suffers in that mess, you know, like everyone's suffering somewhere in there. And so being willing to do our part by connecting with others, by being interested in liberation, whatever form that may look like for us right now. Because that's another thing that's really important for me, is that like Scott and I are very different in this, that I'm a lot younger practitioner in a different tradition. And part of the way that I approached Buddhism was that I just want to be a good person. I want to suffer less. You know, I want to, which I'm sure he does as well, you know, but like even just starting where we're at and like saying, okay, like I value, I have values, and I want to live more in line with my values, but I get in my own way a lot, and I keep getting in my own way a lot. And how can I have more awareness, more clarity, and more responsibility, an ability to respond, and an ability to take responsibility? How can I start where I'm at, and how do I keep going? And a lot of, you know, early on for me was kind of like being interested in the Buddha's Eightfold Path and being interested in practicing sila, which is the foundation of the practice in Theravadan Buddhism, this commitment to living with integrity of speech, integrity of action, and behavior, integrity in the work that I do, you know, bringing integrity into the world and into my relationships and into my workplace and how I handle money. They say that self-esteem is built by doing esteemable acts. If you want to feel good, you got to do things you feel good about. You know, so that's like kind of a starting point, because when I feel good, you know, or when I get that sense of living with integrity and I get the karmic momentum of that and I feel protected by that, it's like I can more easily look at my shitty thinking when I'm living a life of integrity. It's like I'm more willing to look at my shortcomings, because it's like, this is how I found Buddhism. I was in recovery for 5-6 years and 12-step recovery. I was doing all the things that people were telling me to do. I wasn't cheating, I wasn't lying, I wasn't stealing. I was living a life of integrity, but I was still miserable. And it was at that point I was willing to start to look at my mind and how my mind was creating misery, because I could kind of feel safe in doing so. I don't know if that makes sense, but something about living with integrity lets me look at my mind a little bit better. So, you know, we got to start where we're at. We got to start where we're at, and we've got to, you know, finding this intention for the path that we're on. You know, like reconnecting with our intention. I was talking to Scott, and this is something I really love hearing about in his tradition, of just like really taking time in the day to constantly connect with intention for practice. It's kind of like, well, why did I drive out here tonight? Why am I here? Why am I doing? Why do the skillful thing? You know, why live with integrity?
Yeah, I think it has a lot to do with meaning making, and sort of how we make meaning and hold meaning in life. And you know, the Dalai Lama, he often gets asked this question, what's the meaning of life? I think when I was a monk, people used to ask me that, thinking I have like an answer. You know, in Buddha Dharma, it's pretty clear. I mean, what you're saying, I agree with, which is we need to approach also where we are and take the right steps in order to see more clearly and to have honesty and integrity. And then that moves further into a recognition through study and analysis and sort of checking out what the Buddha really said, that there is something called awakening, which, you know, this possibility to be completely free from suffering, which is a radical statement. Not just like reduce suffering, be completely free from it. I think that's radical, at least. And we may even doubt that that's possible, but that's okay. Like, you can doubt it, you should be skeptical and then keep checking, you know, over time. But you know, in the Buddhist path, we generally use intention and we check in with that so that we aim where our practice is going to move. So in the short term, for some of us, an aim might be a little more space, a little more relief from the suffering we experience, the stress we experience, the overwhelm we experience. And then we start to get some sea legs in that. You know, we start to feel comfortable, content with that. And then we're like, I wonder where else this can take me. And so we look deeper and we see, oh, okay, this is what it offers. And then eventually we see, we get a little taste of the nature of phenomena, the nature of reality, the nature of how the self is in movement, is impermanent, is not personal. And so the intention all the while upgrades each time. So intention is not a landing point. Right, it's like you were saying. For me, it's something I'm connecting in with each day, and it's upgrading along with my practice. It's upgrading along with my view. As my view is deepening, and I'm seeing more clearly. I don't know, these days I don't see so clearly, but you know, assuming I was seeing clearly, then the intention also upgrades. So it's a practice. I mean, I'll just say this: a lot of times we just sit down to meditate. We're just like, okay, I'm gonna meditate. We just meditate, right? Yeah, we have to check. Is that so useful? You know, maybe we get a little bit of like relaxation, a little bit of ease, but it's kind of boring after a while. It's kind of like a dead end. So eventually we have to start checking intention. Why am I here? And we have to learn from teachers. Oh, what are the possibilities with this, right? And we check our own understanding. We also might go through a little bit of doubt, which is, I think, can be healthy. A little bit of skepticism. And we check, and then we start to see, oh, that's interesting. I heard of this thing called enlightenment. What is that? And then, you know, at first it seems like, oh, no way could I do that. But then we start to see it's actually part of our nature. It's something we all have. It's something we can bring out as a quality. So again, going from start to finish, intention is progressive, right? And we start where we are, like what Andrew was saying. We have no choice. Even if, like I say, this is the intention to do and this is the best one, you know, come on. Like, some of us are just not going to be able to practice that. And that's okay. But we can also aim for that intention to grow. And how do we grow it? Through checking in every day. First thing what I do when I wake up and check Facebook. Then second thing what I do when I wake up, Instagram. Then third thing is I check my intention, right? This is what happens when you stop being a monk. So the third, then I check my intention. I consciously form a conceptual intention and then try to merge it with my heart, merge it with a feeling. May every action of body, speech, and mind today be directed towards awakening for the benefit of all beings. And so I direct it. And we call this a bodhicitta motivation in the Mahayana tradition. And something that I grow, too. It's not like immediate, right? Some days I feel like it, some days I don't. But it's a practice. So first view, we have to know, where am I going, right? What's the idea? What am I trying to get used to? And then intention is also a way of meditation, right? So meditation is not just sitting like eyes closed, taking a nap. It's really growing intention. That is also a type of meditation, right? But what are we going to intend for? That's the difference. And the Buddhist path is very specific about that, right? Not saying other intentions are valuable. They are. It's just we have to distinguish, what do we want to do? And what's the most bang for our buck? What is going to make our life the most meaningful, right? So from a Buddhist perspective, there's nothing more meaningful than awakening, because it's very much like a doctor. Well, sure, we can go help people as a normal being. An awakened being could do so much more for people. It's like mind-blowing what a Buddha can do. Just one being, the Buddha, look how much good came out of his life, right? Look, 2,600 years. You know, I'm not trying to proselytize here, but really, when you think about it, it's kind of amazing. So many religions got so screwed up in much less time. For Buddhism, we actually still have beings attaining really high realizations. And the authenticity of the teaching hasn't been lost completely. That's kind of amazing when you think about it. Just look how much war is happening because of religion. Buddhism didn't cause any wars yet. It's very unique. So anyways, now I'm definitely propagandizing. So,
so what we want to hear is, how do you get in your own way? Like, how do you look at your views? How do you, you know, what types of awakenings have you had? Moments of awakening in your life? And, you know, how do we set intentions for ourselves? How do we check in around intentions for ourselves? How do we set, Scott and I were talking about earlier, which I love, aspirational goals that are maybe even unattainable? Mm-hmm. You know, like, it's, I think it's important to have some of those, like things that I don't even think are possible that I want to aspire to. I know that for me, like, having that aspiration to be my best version of whoever I'm going to end up being, you know, having that aspiration, it aims, like Scott was saying. So we're interested to hear some discussion, questions, comments, thoughts. I know there's a lot of information. Two neurotics on the stage will do that. but we would love to hear from y'all, questions, comments, thoughts, anything that you guys have. So the floor is open.
Yeah,